Hello everyone, this is Mike Quinsey, Connecting the Light. My guest today is Nick Redfern. He's a very well-known and full-time author who has been on my program before. He specialises, and I think that's the way he would describe it, as writing about a range of unsolved mysteries, including Bigfoot, UFOs and the Loch Ness Monster, alien encounters and government conspiracies. And he also writes for the UFO magazine Fate and Forty and Times. And Nick has appeared on numerous television shows, including one that I always made a point of seeing, which I enjoyed very much, on the History Channels, called Ancient Aliens. But today we're going to talk about his latest book called The World's Weirdest Places. And it's 25 stories about the most strange sites around the world. And I can tell you I've read his book, and I would say it's the best one I've ever read on that subject. So thank you for coming on the programme, Nick.
No, thanks for having me on, Mike.
Now, just a point to cover your background. You seem to have this particular interest in the unsolved mysteries, very much like myself. I could see myself doing your job if I wasn't doing mine. But what started you on that particular subject? I mean, were you always interested in those sort of things as a boy?
Well, kind of. I mean, there was a couple of things, really. When I was about five or six, my mum and dad took me on a week's holiday to Scotland, and we spent a day at Loch Ness. And of course, you know, even at that kind of age, you kind of think of the Loch Ness Monster as it's sort of the equivalent of like a monster in the wardrobe or under the bed, you know, that kind of thing. You don't give it more thought than that. But I still got, you know, a few fragments of memories of my dad telling me the story of the Loch Ness Monster as we stood on the shore of the Loch. Now, that sort of didn't, you know, I wasn't running around chasing monsters or investigating things at 6 years old. But that sort of opened me up, I guess, to that world a little bit. And then, you know, as I got into my teens and whatever, another story from my dad, he was in the British Royal Air Force doing his national service. He worked on radar, and he was involved in a couple of UFO incidents where the guys tracked whatever these things were flying over the English Channel and North Sea, coming from the vicinity of Scandinavia at very high speeds and high altitudes. This went on for like 3 nights, and aircraft were sent up from a nearby Air Force base, Coltishall. He was working at RAF Nita, said, in Norfolk at the time. And everybody involved, when you know the incidents came to an end and they weren't resolved, everybody was told not to talk about, reminded that they'd signed the Official Secrets Act. And my dad didn't tell me till I was about 14, something like that, 13 or 14. And that's what really got me interested, I guess, sort of big time, you know, and I started reading more books on the subject. Things like John Keel's Mothman Prophecies and, you know, some of those sort of late 60s, early 70s type, Brad Steiger type books, that sort of thing.
Yes, yeah.
And when I finished school, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I mean, I wasn't the greatest pupil at all at school. I was pretty useless. I think I left with like 2 CSE grade 4s or something like that. You know, nothing like O levels, no college or university, no A levels, nothing at all. And I kind of wasn't sure what I wanted to do. And I actually got offered a job on one of the old youth opportunities programs that existed back in the 1980s. And it was working on a local magazine in the area I was living at the time. It's called Zero. And it was like a geared towards teenagers, but kind of like one of these free magazines you find, you know, on the shelves in sort of most big cities and whatever. And so I did that for a few years and enjoyed it. And then I thought, well, you know, why not try and combine the background in the paranormal interests with the background I'd sort of developed on the magazine. And so that's basically what I did.
Right. So you've made a living out of it, and you haven't stopped yet. You're still going strong.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's one of these things where people think if you write books, you know, when you say you earn a living, they think you've got like you know, a Ferrari and a house in Beverly Hills or something, it's not like that at all. I mean, freelance writing is a great job if you enjoy writing, and, you know, it's a, and you like it, but I mean, it's one of the most precarious, you know, jobs around. You really have to sort of stay on top of it, and it can be a struggle, you know. But again, I mean, it's something I enjoy, so I'd rather be doing something I enjoy than, you know, raking in a million and getting up thinking, oh, God, why am I doing this every day? You know what I mean? So.
Absolutely, yes. Now, I'm going to ask you a question about your book because I know what I think, but which story do you like the most?
That's a good question. I mean, I'd actually, just to go back to it, I think I probably would say Loch Ness, and the reason being that, you know, everybody thinks of Loch Ness, they think of the Loch Ness Monster or monsters.
Yes.
A lot of people don't realise all the other weirdness that goes on at the Loch as well, and that has done for literally decades. You know, it's just everything's dominated by the monster story until you dig into it and you see what a really weird place it is. I mean, back at the turn of the 20th century, the famous occultist Aleister Crowley had a house on the shores of Loch Ness, which is still there. It's called Burleskin House. And he engaged in all sorts of weird rites and rituals to try and summon up demons from inside the loch. And Burleskin House was later owned by Jimmy Page, the guitarist in Led Zeppelin. And in the 70s, Jimmy Page said the house had this weird atmosphere to it. But there's a cemetery not too far from the house itself, which is connected by an old tunnel, which was supposedly a safe haven for a witch coven centuries ago. There've been UFO sightings over the Loch. There was even a famous Man in Black type encounter in 1973 on the shores of the Loch when a Loch Ness monster researcher named Ted Holliday, he used to go there for years, and he believed initially that the Loch Ness monster was a flesh and blood animal, but eventually came round to believing it was something paranormal or supernatural. And he said that one day he saw this, literal, like a man in black, standing on the shore just glaring at him, who just literally kind of vanished into nothingness. And on top of that, there are sightings of sort of these classic alien big cats, as they become known, kind of like the Beast of Bodmin and the Beast of Exmoor at Loch Ness. And finally, the other weird thing at the Loch is that in the Second World War, there was a crash of a Wellington aircraft in the Loch, and all the crew got out apart from one, the tail gunner, who got killed. There have been sightings of ghostly airmen wandering around the shores of the Loch as if sort of, you know, dazed and disoriented. And again, he sort of fades out into nothingness as well. So, you know, from a location which is weird in one sense because it has a lake monster tradition attached to it, we then find that arguably probably the world's most famous occultist lived there, tried to summon up demons. There are big cats there, men in black, UFOs. You know, the list just goes on and on.
Yes, because the airman you're talking about was Pete Smithson, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, that's right. He was the guy who witnessed, back in the late 1970s, this figure that came out of the Loch early one morning, like a foggy morning. Yeah. Seemed to be dragging a parachute behind him, but didn't have sort of, you know, like the advanced flying suit that people have on today. Right. You know, this was sort of like a typical 1940s era uniform, but he just kind of pointed enigmatically and then vanished into nothing.
Weird, aren't they? Now, just again, another question about these 25 sites. Have you actually visited every one?
No, I visited about 15 of them. But what I did for the remainder was to rely on the testimony and research of friends and colleagues who had been there. For example, I mean, one place that I didn't go to was Guyana in South America. But a friend of mine, Richard Freeman, went there about 3 or 4 years ago and spent like nearly a month there tracking down all these different legends of strange animals and weird creatures in the woods and the lakes and mountains. So that was sort of one of the main criteria I was looking for, was not to be reliant on, you know, the internet or other books, but to do first-hand research where possible and to get, you know, related photographs and whatever, which I did for about 15 of the stories. And as I said, the remaining 10 were all reliant on other people who'd been there as well. So, you know, it wasn't a case of just typing in Loch Ness into, you know, Google or whatever and just doing that way.
That's interesting that you've been to so many anyway. Now, the first site you cover in the book is the Bermuda Triangle. Mm-hmm. And I shouldn't think there's anybody alive who hasn't heard about the Bermuda Triangle. Yeah. And for me personally, I'm always amazed at the story about the five Navy Avenger aircraft that disappeared. But not only that, that the search aircraft that was sent out afterwards also disappeared. Now, I think that's amazing.
Bermuda Triangle's a weird place. I mean, I haven't sailed on it, but I have actually flown through it when I went to Puerto Rico on one occasion. And, you know, it's only actually when I think it was the pilot or one of the crew members said, oh, you might be interested to know we just left the Bermuda Triangle. I guess they waited till we'd left, you know, before telling the passengers were about to fly through it, you know. I think it would have been kind of cool if they'd have told us beforehand, but maybe some people might have had a heart attack or something, you never know.
Well, yes, but, you have to be careful.
But, I mean, it is a very weird place. There's no doubt about that. Now, I'll be the first to admit that, you know, if you're on the oceans, particularly in a small boat or you're not used to it, you can get disoriented. But the level of weird reports from that particular area compared to other parts of the world does seem far higher than it should be. You know, it's not like it just balances out all across the planet. Now, the Bermuda Triangle itself, it sort of extends through north to south Florida, then right across to the Bahamas, then past Puerto Rico, and then back to Bermuda again. It has this sort of broadly, although not exactly triangular, shape to it. But the most famous case, you're right, is this one of 1945, December 45 specifically, where five U.S. Navy aircraft, Avenger aircraft, all vanished on one particular day. And the circumstances surrounding this disappearance, I mean, they were sort of, you know, beyond weird. Basically, what happened was that you had these five aircraft that all took off from a military base in Florida and headed east across the Atlantic Ocean. And it wasn't long before they started reporting that they, you know, they were like disoriented, confused. They weren't sure where they were. They talked about the ocean and the sky looking strange, which were intriguing statements, but they didn't sort of elaborate on what they meant. But they just couldn't recognize where they were. Now, that suggests like a degree of disorientation of the mind. And what kind of supports that theory is that, you know, if you're on the U.S. mainland and you head east out towards the Atlantic and you get lost, well, all you got to do is look at your compass and head west because that'll take you back to land. You know, you don't even need to be a pilot to know that. You know, it's like east is the opposite of west on the compass. But they didn't even think to do that. They just seemed to have been flying around in circles to the point where we don't really know what happened to them. I mean, some people suggest they ditched in the ocean, which isn't impossible. But the problem is no wreckage was ever found. No bodies were ever found. And there was never anything like an oil slick or a telltale petrol slick on the ocean, you know, if the planes had broken up or exploded. So we don't really know what happened to them at all. Some people talk about them being kind of sucked into portals and doorways to other realms or dimensions. But what made it even weirder is that shortly after the planes, when it became pretty clear that, you know, there had been a big disaster of some sort and the entire squadron was gone, a follow-up plane or a number of planes were actually sent up to try and locate them. They sort of scoured the area for a while. But what was strangest of all was that one of these chase planes also vanished. And what was even more intriguing was just like with the squadron itself, this chase plane, again, nothing was found of it, no bodies, and again, no petrol slick, you know, on the ocean. So for all intents and purposes, all six planes, but in two separate incidents, had literally totally vanished.
That's very interesting. There's a couple of things that I have read related to that I found interesting. One was that when the airmen were in touch with their base and expressing this problem that they had in not recognising anything, etc., etc. There was a final call made, which apparently was never put out, where one of the airmen said that his craft was starting to, in a manner of speaking, sort of just disappear in front of his eyes. And I thought that was interesting, because I also heard on a separate occasion that they believe there is a time warp there, and what happens is these planes move into another level of vibration, and they do literally disappear, which would sort of fit the story, really.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of one of the main scenarios, is that, you know, rather than being sort of sucked into the sea or, you know, kidnapped by aliens, that there are sort of portals or rifts or doorways that,
yes,
you know, that ships, people, planes, whatever, can get sucked into through some, you know, some through science that we don't really understand yet. I mean, things like quantum physics are allowing for the existence today of sort of extra and multi-dimensions. So the idea is that maybe at random, at chance, or who knows, that occasionally these portals open, and if you're in the wrong place at the right time, or the wrong time, I should say, you know, you get sucked in, and then the worst-case scenario is you've got no way to get out on the other side, you know, once you are in that other realm.
Yes, I tend to believe that. And, of course, one mustn't forget that ships disappear in the same manner, and some people have actually observed a ship disappear within their sight.
Yeah, that's one of the things. There are cases of, you know, that seem to be literal disappearances. I mean, ships and boats and aircraft disappear in the sense that we don't find them, but there are a few reports where people have talked about, you know, boats literally kind of fading away into nothingness or becoming shrouded by a green fog and start to, you know, wink out of existence almost. So I think there's something to that theory. So.
Certainly a strange place. Now, before we come away from the Bermuda Triangle, tell our listeners about the experience of Lieutenant Robert, was it Olmers?
Olmer, yeah. Well, he had an interesting story. I mean, again, you know, when you've got sort of credible people speaking on the record, that makes it all the more valuable. But Olmer was, he served with the US military during the Second World War, and it was in the latter part of 1943, and he was flying through the Triangle at the time. And bear in mind, this was long before the term Bermuda Triangle was even created. But he was flying through the area that would become known as the Bermuda Triangle when he started to experience a lot of weird and sudden turbulence out of nowhere, where the plane was sort of thrown high into the air and then it would suddenly just fall. I mean, literally, you know, just drop like a stone by thousands of feet. And this literally sort of went on and on and on. And the entire crew, bear in mind, this wasn't like a little fighter plane. This was a bomber. It was like a Boeing B-24 or something like that. And the crew were all ready to bail out when suddenly the aircraft sort of corrected itself in flight, and the turbulence and everything else was gone. But what was weird was that it just literally came out of nowhere and vanished out of nowhere. And at the time, there weren't sort of massive thunderclouds or anything like that in the sky. Now, what made it all the more intriguing was that years later, I mean, literally like 30 years later, we're talking late 70s, one of the crewmen, whose name was Dr. Robert Rigby, he was the navigator on that plane. And he came to believe that, you know, this weird turbulence wasn't just due to the weather. He felt there was some sort of strange power or energy in the area that had the ability to affect sort of, you know, aircraft engines and that kind of thing.
Okay, yeah, yet another interesting story. Now, I'd like to move on to, hope I've pronounced this correctly. Is it Bangor, India?
Bangor, yeah, Bangor in India. Yeah, yeah, that's probably, a very strange place, yeah.
Well, you mentioned there was the ruins of an historic city, which dates apparently back to the 16th century. But I think the mystery you found there was the reasons, or lack of reasons, perhaps, why it became a ghost town.
Yeah, well Bangor is, although it's an old ruined city and pretty much, like you said, a ghost town, There's no reason why it should be like that. I mean, it's actually a massive city, or it was a massive city, that even today, the number of buildings that still stand is in excess of 10,000. You know, and as I said, we're not talking about mud huts or anything like that. We're talking about huge, sprawling buildings made of stone. And, you know, it would today serve as an ideal place for people to live in with, you know, obviously it would need renovating, et cetera. But, I mean, for all intents and purposes, the city is still there. And it's located in the Indian state of Rajasthan. And, as you said, it was dated back to the 1600s. And, I mean, back then it was sort of like a typical bustling ancient city, you know, with temples, marketplaces, you know, just places like that that you would see in regular history. Now, what sort of typifies Bangalore more than anything else in terms of weirdness is that not too long after it was built, everybody, I mean, we're talking like a century, which in terms of, you know, the life of a city isn't a long time. Everybody just literally sort of fled the area. And when I say everybody fled, I mean literally everybody fled. It became a ghost town overnight. Now, in terms of the down-to-earth theories, people talk about, you know, everything from like a recession to droughts in the area, you know, and food drying up and animals and crops dying and people just moving on, and suggesting that all this and the, you know, recession and everything else all came at the same time. So people were like, we've had enough and we're leaving. And that's not impossible. But why I mention this story in the book is because there are a number of notable legends surrounding it that suggest the people of the city fled for very different reasons. Now, there are three very similar legends, which they all have their own sort of slightly different storylines with different people involved, but they basically all come down to kind of like a shamanic type character or magician or wizard who dabbled into sort of the sort of dark side of magic and who believed that the area where the city was built was on sacred ground that basically belonged to him. And he said that, you know, if the city's built and people live here, it's going to end in disaster and tragedy and death for everyone. Now, you know, whether people sort of believe in curses and things like that, the fact is there was a lot of deep disaster in that area. There was a huge outbreak of sort of very virulent virus that, you know, attacked a lot of people. We're not really sure what that was. Then there was a war with an opposing city in the area where many of the royal family of Bangor were killed. So it was like an air of bad luck and disaster had just fallen upon the city. And that's what a lot of people attribute to this curse put on by this shamanic type character. So that is sort of the background to it. But even more weird is that today, Bangor itself is very much like a tourist attraction because a lot of people go there knowing the legends and the stories. And many people have talked about, you know, they've decided to stay overnight and heard what sound like the echoey sort of noises and bustling voices you would hear when it was sort of a full-bodied city, you know, back in the 1600s, almost as if the echo or some essence of the people of the city of that era has been retained. And, you know, sometimes it sort of echoes around, I guess, when the time's right, so to speak.
Yes. Oh, that's interesting. Now, it's uncanny that through a lot of your stories, in other words, the places in the book, in addition to what else you may have been investigating, there seems to be quite a bit of evidence of these big, hairy, apish-like beings that we probably better know as Bigfoot. And I notice you also mentioned that in respect of the Caucasus Mountains, Eurasia. Yeah. Would you like to make a comment about that, particularly regarding the sighting by the detachment of police?
Yeah, sure. Well, this is one of the places in the book that I didn't go to, but Richard Freeman, who I mentioned earlier, went to Guyana a couple of years ago. He also went on an expedition to the Caucasus Mountains, again for about a month, and spent a massive amount of time sort of getting the local people to speak to him, you know, and trusting him, etc. And this brought forth a massive amount of previously unheard of testimony of people who claim to have seen these huge, hairy, ape-like or ape-man-like figures. Now, what's interesting is that there almost seems to be sort of two types in the Caucasus Mountains. One is described as almost like a literal equivalent of the Bigfoot of North America or the Yeti of the Himalayas. But another one is described far more like a primitive human, kind of like Neanderthal man or Cro-Magnon man, in the sense, you know, it's sort of a primitive-looking human with a sort of heavy brow and wide nose and covered in hair, but not ape-like, you know, just more primitive. So, but bear in mind also the Caucasus Mountains, you know, they haven't changed for hundreds of thousands of years, neither has the climate, as far as we're aware, to any significant degree. So, you know, if there were pockets of surviving ape men or something along those lines there, that possibly would be one of the few places left on the planet where these creatures could conceivably exist and not be found or captured. Now, we actually do have a couple of stories from the Second World War. Certainly the most significant one was reported by a policeman who was working with the military in the Caucasus Mountains in 1944. His name was Urgib Koshokoyev. And he was basically a part of a contingent, a military contingent, that was patrolling to make sure there weren't any sort of incursions by the Nazis, because obviously at this time, you know, the Nazis were against the Allies, but they were also, you know, trying to get a big foothold in the former Soviet Union as well. So Koshokoyev was basically a part of this military detachment. And there have been a number of reports of people in this one particular area of the Caucasus Mountains where they're on patrol, of people seeing this large hairy creature sort of raiding farms at night and stealing animals and, you know, fruit and vegetables, that kind of thing. And so they kept a close look out for it, and sure enough, on one particular occasion, actually saw it. And they tried to capture it, but it bounded away at very high speed to a local shepherd's place where he would store his animals where it got too cold. And there was like a cabin adjacent to it. And they decided to try and, sure, one of the guys tried to shoot the animal, but Koshkoyev basically chastised the guy for doing that and said, no, don't kill it because it looks something like a man. And they decided to try and take it alive. And so what they did, they saw it head towards this cabin, presumably for safety, but the cabin was locked, it couldn't get inside, and it was prowling around. So what they did, they basically formed like a circle around the building, and they were going to try and capture it and lock it inside the cabin. But what they didn't realize, that it was so dark that it was actually lurking right by the front door. And it was only as they got really close to the cabin that it suddenly reared up and charged in between them and headed off into the night. And these creatures locally are known as owl masties. But what's interesting, again, is that the soldiers concerned, because they literally got right up to the darkness of the door before they literally stumbled upon him almost, they described him not as how, you know, people describe Bigfoot, as like this huge 8-foot-tall ape. It was described as like a 6-foot-tall, primitive, hairy human. And, you know, all the guys were convinced that that's exactly what it was. And, you know, as I said, Koshokoyev, that was his real name. He spoke on the record. We can verify his background with the police and working with the military. So in that sense, you know, it's a very important story demonstrating probably, you know, the existence of some sort of surviving pocket of an ancient human, if you like.
Yeah. Very fascinating. Now, another place that, again, everybody must have heard of, which is rather a strange place, is Death Valley in California.
Yeah.
I like the story told by Howdy Hill of L.A., and I was intrigued by the idea that there were apparently miles and miles of tunnels underneath Death Valley. Would you like to say a bit about that site?
Yeah, sure. Well, Death Valley in California, it's sort of kind of an appropriate name because it actually holds the official record for the highest temperature actually recorded in the Western world. And that was 136 degrees Fahrenheit, which nobody would want to get stuck in that height. And so I guess, you know, Death Valley is a good name for the place. But as I said, it's located in the Mojave Desert in California. And over the years, there have been a number of stories suggesting, basically most of them come from sort of real-life Indiana Jones-type characters. And these stories predominantly surfaced in the late 1920s through the late 1930s. And they were all along the same lines of sort of gold prospectors and explorers and adventurers, either knowing of or literally stumbling upon and finding very deep caverns below Death Valley, which they've been able to access in some cases by hidden caves and caverns. And in one case, the story is that one of the prospectors was trying to dig like what they call a sinkhole in the area, where he literally fell through into one of these caverns. And they're essentially kind of described as being something that would sort of be akin to, I guess, you know, ancient Rome or ancient Greece, you know, or the inside of the pyramids, where they were ancient stone areas with treasures and jewelry and statues, that kind of thing. And, you know, what they were exactly or who built them, that's the big question. You know, we're talking about potentially, you know, structures built, as the theory suggests, some sort of ancient American civilization that came long before the Native Americans. And what's interesting is a number of people in the 1930s who claimed to have found these areas made an offer to local scientists and archaeologists. They were like, well, you know, we'll take you along and show them to you. And all of these guys were totally skeptical, and they said, no, we're not going to, we don't want to see it or anything at all. So ironically, you know, the people in a position to actually take these stories further refused to check out the evidence, which is something which is typical, you know, the skeptics and the debunkers, in whether it's UFOs, cryptozoology, anything. You know, they just don't want to come out and do the work, so to speak, to see the evidence for themselves. And so it's kind of ironic that these people were saying, you know, we found these ancient areas underground that look like something of archaeological significance. We'll take you to see them. And they're all like, no, you know, we don't believe it. We're not interested.
Doesn't really stand thinking that someone who is interested in that type of thing wouldn't jump at the thought of finding something that was very ancient, because I don't know what it was based on, but I think you said there was some feeling that the tunnel system, which was 180 square miles of 32 tunnels, was something maybe getting on to 80,000 years old. I mean, am I correct on that?
Yeah, that was the theory, that, you know, it was the last sort of underground or surviving remnants of some ancient race that existed in the U.S. literally, you know, tens of thousands of years ago, and that got wiped out or, you know, became extinct, destroyed itself. We don't know. And that's not impossible. I mean, you know, even in the Middle East today, they're still finding remains of ancient cities that nobody knew it were even there, you know, 10, 20 years ago. They still find ancient foundations the more they dig down. So the idea that there could be places like this under sort of Death Valley and the Mojave Desert isn't out of the question. And so for that reason, you know, it is ironic that the skeptics don't address these type of things. But unfortunately, you know, that's exactly what happens. I think a lot of it is they worry so much about their reputations that when a controversial story comes along, they just won't deal with it. You know, it's like they've got grants from universities or, letters after their name, and they think it'll sort of color their stance, you know, if they're allied or tied to something that's perceived as being a bit weird or whatever.
No, I think
what's actually called? It's called a lack of guts, is what it's called.
Well, I think you're right there. It possibly is the answer in most cases. Now, still in California, what about the Devil's Gate at Pasadena?
Yeah, this is one I've been to on a couple of occasions, and this is a very weird place. Devil's Gate Dam is located, it's basically in like a small valley area of Pasadena, which is just on the fringes of Los Angeles. So, you know, it's sort of like a valley-type location that most people in the area never go to, and certainly most people probably don't even know about. But you kind of imagine if you're in like a big English city like London or Birmingham, and you sort of travel to the fringes of it, and suddenly you're in the countryside, and there's this huge dip down, and almost like a little hidden valley with, you know, massive amounts of trees and streams and surrounded by hills, where it's very quiet as well because the wind actually sort of whips around and prevents sort of the sound echoing from the city. So you're almost in like a vacuum as well. But it's called Devil's Gate Dam because at the foot of this particular dam that basically provides water to the people of Pasadena, there's this natural outcrop of rock which has this sort of side profile that looks just like a demon or a devil. It's like a got a horn on top and then like a protruding nose and forehead and eye and mouth, and it really does look like a side profile of a demon, and that's how it would develop this name, Devil's Gate Dam. But what's interesting is the sheer amount of weirdness and strangeness that has developed around that area. For example, just behind the dam itself, you have NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab, and much of the early work that went towards the creation of the JPL was done by a guy named Jack Parsons. And Jack Parsons, in the 1930s and 40s and through the early 50s, was a brilliant rocket scientist whose company, the Aerojet Corporation, in later years built the solid rocket boosters for NASA's space shuttle missions.
Yes.
And but as well as being a famous and noted rockets expert, Parsons was also a big occultist. He was actually a follower of Aleister Crowley, who we mentioned in relation to Loch Ness. And before every rocket flight out in Pasadena, he would invoke the Greek god Pan to try and ensure a safe flight. And he would do all these rites and rituals to, again, to try and ensure that everything went well. And this was when he was actually under a top secret clearance with the military to develop rockets for them. And, of course, the military were like, they just sort of shook their heads and rolled their eyes and said, well, if he can get the job done, you know, we don't really care what he does in his free time. Mm-hmm. It's kind of intriguing that he was doing all these rites and rituals based on Crowley's teachings at the very area where you've got this sort of demonic head of stone. Now, as well as that, very near the dam, there's an old bridge, which locally is known as Suicide Bridge. And the reason it's called Suicide Bridge is because since its construction approximately a century ago, the figure today is more than 100 people who've thrown themselves off the bridge to their deaths below, you know, as if it's got some sort of bleak, dark atmosphere to it, you know, that just suddenly provokes people to kill themselves. Mm-hmm. And in the late 1950s, there's a very, very weird and disturbing series of child murders right by the dam itself as well, which were admitted to being done by a guy named Mac Ray Edwards, who committed suicide in prison one day before Halloween in 1970. So again, it's almost like with the Devil's Gate Dam, that with the suicide bridge and the murders and everything else, it's like there's this negative atmosphere almost sort of hangs over this area. And a lot of people have felt that. They've gone down there, you know, expecting a nice walk through the woods where they can take the dog or whatever. And they have this uneasy feeling that although they can't put the finger on it, there's something not right and unsettling about the area. And, you know, sometimes people think that, you know, that in an area can kind of absorb tragedy, if you like, and, you know, people can pick up on it even.
Yes, I tend to believe that. I think the energy we put out is contained in objects around us, so I think that's quite possible. But for me, one of the most peculiar things about that area was the incident you mentioned about Tommy Bowman, an 8-year-old lad who actually disappeared in front of his family.
Yeah, I mean, that's a weird one where, I mean, some people have suggested maybe he was one of the victims of this, you know, this killer, Mac Ray Edwards, who was, you know, he was a deranged child killer, you know, a very dangerous person who ended up in the best place, which was in prison. But there were one or two of these child disappearances where the parents are with them. It was kind of like, you know, they were 10 yards in front of them on the old path, you know, running around just playing. And they vanished literally like that, you know. I mean, in some cases, or in most of the cases, it was when, you know, kids were riding their bikes around the area on their own or with just one friend. But he was with his entire family and just, you know, just like in the click of a finger was gone when he was just maybe 20, 30 feet in front and should not have been able to vanish that quickly without sort of screaming or crying for help or whatever. So there are a number of cases where it gets confusing is that Macrae Edwards admitted to some of the murders, but others he didn't. Now, of course, if he'd admitted to some, logic would suggest, well, if he did all the rest, why not just admit to them as well? You know, he was going in prison, he was never coming out, and he admitted to some. You know, why leave some hanging in midair in terms of who did it? So, you know, maybe there's a potential that not everything, you know, could be applied to him. But I guess, you know, sort of 56, 57 years on, we're never really going to know now, I don't think at all.
Right. It reminds me a little bit of, I can't remember if it was Ayers Rock or somewhere else where, I think it was a young girl disappeared when she was climbing. Yeah. Was that Picnic Rock or something?
Yeah, that's right. I didn't include that in the book because it is a famous... I did actually think about it, ironically, but because it's a famous story, but I didn't find anything else weird enough where, you know, there's a whole range of weirdness. It was that story and that was about it. So, but there are, you know, there are cases like that of, you know, just sudden disappearances and, you know, in locations and when there are people around when it just shouldn't happen, you know.
Yeah, weird, isn't it? Now, another place that's intriguing and a little bit like the Bermuda Triangle is the Devil's Sea, Japan. And you talk about alien encounters there. Tell us a bit about that.
Well, yeah, well, the Devil's Sea is probably the, you know, the sort of little brother or and lesser known brother to the Bermuda Triangle. But it's very, very similar in the sense that over the centuries, you know, there have ships have vanished, boats have vanished, and in latter day years, aircraft have disappeared. Now, because Japan's a very ancient country, the big difference between the Devil's Sea in Japan and the Bermuda Triangle is that the stories date back long, long before. Now, the Devil's Sea is actually not too far from the coast of Tokyo. It's around about 60 miles or thereabouts. But even sort of 1,000 years ago, possibly even more, the Japanese people realized that this was an area of very deep strangeness. And the reason they knew that was because they recognized that their ships and boats and galleons and things like that would consistently and keep vanishing in this particular area. And because at the time there was a lot of mythology and folklore about dragons, you know, in Japanese culture, as there is in Chinese culture, the first theory was, you know, it was gigantic sea dragons pulling the people and the ships down to sort of like a watery grave, which they'd never get away from. But that's I think, you know, we can apply kind of strange things all around the world to the folklore and beliefs of the people of those particular eras. So, you know, unless one day dragons are proved to be a literal reality, which I don't think they will be, you know, I think that's something we could apply more to mythology. But it doesn't take away the important fact that they recognized that there were weird disappearances. Now, you know, you mentioned the UFO angle. I talk about this in the book in relation to the Devil's Sea, and one of the stories relates to a guy named Takeo Tada, who was flying through the Devil's Sea in the early 1970s, and he saw like a classic flying saucer, you know, the sort of flying saucer that you would see in the early writings, you know, sort of 1947 onwards, that we see less of today, but, you know, that all the at the height back then. And this was described as a typical flying saucer. I think it was around 60 to 70 feet, something like that, circular-shaped, very, very shiny. And only actually about, I think it was about 10 feet in thickness, something like that. And he said that, you know, he was just amazed to see this thing sort of hanging and flying over the Devil's Sea. But what was interesting is that, you know, in many cases where aircraft pursue UFOs or they're seen by them, you know, the UFOs streak away at high speed. But Takeo Tada said that this classic flying saucer was barely moving at something like 100 miles an hour. And because, you know, he was in a regular aircraft, he actually had to fight to not collide with it. You know, he had to sort of circle around it. And, you know, if he got too close, kind of do a loop. Because otherwise, you know, he would either have overtaken it and had to turn around, or if he'd have carried on going towards it, he would have literally hit it. But he described, he was able to get close enough to see that there certainly weren't any windows on it. There was no tail, no wings, nothing like that at all. And he just basically, he didn't know what to do. So he just, you know, he wasn't a military pilot. He was just in like a light plane, like a propeller plane. And so he just followed it for about 10 minutes, not sure what to do, until it just started to rise and went into the clouds and then ultimately vanished. But, you know, his case was an interesting one because it's not that often that somebody has the fortunate enough experience to get really close, you know, to a UFO, to where you can actually make a detailed look at it. But I guess, you know, if you're in an aircraft that's only sort of doing 120 miles an hour and the UFO is barely doing 100, then that gives you kind of a unique perspective. And for all places for it to appear, you know, the Devil's Sea, that kind of brings in the weirdness of the area as well.
Yes, indeed. Now, a couple of weeks ago, I came back from Sedona, and I noticed you have Sedona mentioned in your book. Yeah, you talk about supernatural entities, UFO encounters, etc. I certainly felt it was a very, what I would describe as a magical place with a very active energy there. What did you find out yourself?
Yeah, well, I mean, a lot of people do think that. I mean, they, when you go to Sedona, Arizona, which I've been to on a few occasions, you do get this sort of sense of, I guess for people, you know, as your show's in England, the best way I can describe it is it's kind of a similar feeling to that I've got when every time I've been to Glastonbury in Somerset. It has sort of this magical, old, but sort of hard to define energy or, you know, atmosphere to it that seems strange and bizarre and magical almost, but it's difficult to sort of pinpoint and understand why you get that feeling. But you do. It's sort of going into almost like a, you know, some sort of twilight dream world or something like that, I guess. There have been a lot of people who have been trekking through the mountains that surround the town, and actually reproduce in the book one of the a photograph I took about 11 years ago, in the mountains of Sedona, demonstrating where people have reported, you know, they're walking up the trails and they'll suddenly feel like they've hit this sudden wave of energy where, for example, their hair goes static, or, you know, they feel like that classic static electricity feeling. Or even kind of like they're wading in mud, as if, you know, there's like a thick energy there that they can't see, but that's affecting their ability to move. And it's often in these occasions that other strange things happen. I mean, I talk about one case in the book where a woman sort of hit one of these energy walls at the same time as she saw this little humanoid creature sort of run parallel to the trail. And what's intriguing is that the local Native American tribes that used to live there, they had these legends of these so-called little people, you know, kind of like the equivalents in Europe of like goblins and trolls and that sort of thing, that lived in the caves and caverns of Sedona. But it was interesting that her case wasn't just of one of these small dwarfish figures, but it occurred in the same vicinity and same time as this portal. And so, you know, those are two of the, I guess, the prime things that people report are these vortexes or energy areas and these strange little creatures. But there have also been a lot of UFO sightings in the area. I talk about one from the 1940s where a man actually reported his case officially, and the documentation surfaced through the Freedom of Information Act. And he was driving home and saw this strange, again, like a typical flying saucer just hanging over one of the mountains, and there was an official investigation by the government to try and determine what this thing was, but, you know, no answers were forthcoming, which isn't surprising. You know, when reports surface a day or two later, there's not really a great deal that can be done. But so there's a lot of stuff like that, and even Bigfoot reports. You know, you mentioned how places like the Caucasus Mountains are weird, and they have Bigfoot sightings. Well, there've been quite a few Bigfoot reports from Sedona. What makes their reports interesting is that many of those cases involve these creatures just winking out, you know, as if they've literally opened an invisible doorway or something like that.
Well, that's very interesting. I didn't get enough time to really gather that sort of information, but yes, I certainly found it to be quite a place to be in.
Yeah.
Now, I think I'll cover one more and then give you an opportunity to give our listeners your website and tell them where your book can be obtained from. But I found another place that's fascinating. It's Reykjavik in Iceland. You talk about elves, trolls, fairies and goblins and something called a worm monster. That all sounds rather interesting.
Yeah, I mean, Reykjavik in Iceland, the capital of Iceland, is probably, I guess, in terms of size and the number of people, it's probably the most densely weird place in the world. Mm-hmm. You know, there's so much going on there. Throughout Iceland, particularly in Reykjavik, the local people, you know, have a sort of a deep reverence and belief and respect, you know, for the sort of paranormal entities that they believe sort of lurk around Reykjavik. They call them the hidden people. Well, that's the English translation. In Icelandic, they're called Holtvolk. And for all intents and purposes, we would describe them as like elves and trolls, think creatures like that, you know, that would sort of live in caverns, caves, or under bridges, you know, according to folklore and that type of thing. But what's interesting is that whereas, you know, say in Britain, everybody knows the stories of elves and goblins, most people, for the most part, at least, you know, just relegate them to folklore. In Reykjavik, it's very different. You know, when they're building new roads and things like this, if there's an area where there's a tradition that an elf lives, they actually divert the roadways around them, you know, for fear of invoking bad luck or things like that. You know, you can imagine the British Roadway Services, you know, doing that. But, you know, it's like take a chunk out the M5 or whatever. But as well as that, I mean, there's a lot of other strange stuff going on in Reykjavik as well. I mean, I talk about how there's a large lake on the fringes of the city, which has a story very similar to the Loch Ness Monster. It's a very old story. It goes back a couple of centuries. But it talks about how this creature, which was described as like a huge worm-like animal that would sometimes surface from the lake, which is known as Lagflot. And basically, it was described, you know, not like the Loch Ness Monster with like a huge humped back, you know, and flippers like that, but it was more like a worm or a giant snake. But that seemed to have magical attributes to it as well, in terms of it could be sort of conjured up and, you know, if people did rites and rituals, it would surface out of the lake, you know, according to the people who are trying to entice it by magic. But what's more intriguing, at least, or equally intriguing, is that in this very same lake and an adjacent river, I found some U.S. Air Force files at the National Archives where in the 1950s there had been a joint Icelandic-American investigation of a strange object that had reportedly crashed in the waters. And it was described as being like about a 10 to 12 foot long cylinder-shaped object that nobody knew what it was at all. And it ended up, the report was sent to the U.S. Air Force's UFO project at the time, and personnel were sent out. There was a military base on Iceland, a U.S. military base, and they asked for permission from the Icelandic people or the Icelandic government, you know, can we accompany you? And they said, well, yeah, sure. And so they all went out there and tried to find whatever this object was. As far as we know, it wasn't recovered. But, you know, just the sheer fact that you've got this crashed UFO story in the same body of water that centuries ago you had a lake monster, And just down the road, you know, you have these trolls and elves and goblins running around, all, right, you know, within spitting distance of each other.
Yes, very intriguing. These are some of the things around us that don't very often come to our notice, because no, unless someone like you writes a book about it, we probably wouldn't hear. Now, tell our listeners your website address and where they can get your book from.
Well, people can reach me at nickredfern14, fortean.blogspot.com, or nickredfernsbooks.blogspot.com, or they can reach me on Facebook, Twitter, and as far as the books, they can get them online, like Amazon, or you should be able to get them, if you're not on the shelves from a local bookshop, then certainly they can order them in for people as well.
Right, that's fine. I have to thank you very much for coming onto the programme, Nick.
Well,
it was so interesting. It's so interesting. I haven't noticed the time flying by. very intriguing, I have to say, on your behalf, that if you want to hear the rest of these strange stories, buy Nick's book.
All right, well, thanks, Mike.
You're very welcome, Nick. I thoroughly enjoyed speaking with you about that. Thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Right, friends, that really was interesting. Next week, I've got Jules Maloney, who's coming onto the programme so that we can discuss her book called Mary Magdalene, The Christos Sophia Revelation. And it's the result of the channeling she's received from what she calls the Christ Magdalene. And she said it's very important to get this information out at this special time when we're coming up to the end of this cycle of duality. So thank you for being with me today, and I do hope you can make it next week. God bless you all. Thank you.